WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may be surprised to hear that one of the most powerful screenwriters in early Hollywood, the highest paid screenwriter for several years, was a woman. She wrote over 200 films, including the first Stella Dallas and Anna Christie. She won Oscars for The Champ and The Big House. She wrote hit films for her friend Mary Pickford, including Poor Little Rich Girl, Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, and Pollyanna. But her name is not well known, which is something her biographer is trying to change. My guest Carrie Beecham's biography is called Without Lying Down, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is now screening films by Marion and the Powerful Women of Early Hollywood. Beecham says that Frances Marion's success is in some ways not so surprising. Women wrote half of the Hollywood films produced before 1925. I asked Beecham why it was easier then for women to break into screenwriting.
Women, remember, in the teens and early 20s were also directors and producers. And I've come to conclude that the reason for that was that filmmaking was more collaborative, that women thrived in that collaborative setting. It wasn't filmmaking by committee because everybody did have their role. But it was collaborative. It was way before the time that we think of now as the auteur days of the director, of the great director, or of a single person putting their stamp on a film. These people truly did work together. One of the most joyous times for Frances was in 1917 when she was signed as the exclusive screenwriter for Mary Pickford. And she and Mary Pickford and their friend Mickey Nealon, who was the director, created half a dozen films in 2 years that set incredible box office records. And here I'm talking about Pollyanna and The Little Princess and films like that. But at the time, what's truly amazing to me is that Frances was 28, Mary was 25, and Mickey was 26.
And the medium was very young, too.
The medium was very young. That was another key for why women were allowed in. And not only allowed in, but then once they were in, were nurtured and flourished, was that very few people took the movie-making business seriously as a business. It was so quick. It was growing so quickly. And films would be an idea 1 week, before the camera the next, in the theaters the next month. It was a very quick turnaround. And the Wall Street didn't really start to pay attention until the middle 20s.
Now, you mentioned that Frances Marion wrote a lot of films for Mary Pickford, and Mary Pickford had this sweet, naive image on screen. Wasn't she called America's Sweetheart?
Yes.
But off screen, she was a real dynamo, from what I understand.
She was an incredible woman, truly incredible woman. And having seen all of her films now and, of course, reading all the scripts, I grew to have tremendous respect for her talent. She also was in many ways encaptured by this image. She would play roles like Pollyanna, the glad girl, the little sweetheart, and her fans would love it. And then she would try to stretch with a film like Stella Maris or The Love Light, where she played married woman falling in love with a German spy. And the fans did not like to see their little Mary in those type of roles. And so while she personally felt the desire to stretch and prove herself this great actress, she was forced time and time again, for commercial purposes, to return to the little girl role.
Did Frances
Marion? And I think eventually she suffered from that.
Did Frances Marion write a lot of those little girl roles for her, and did Frances Marion try to help her out of that image?
Frances wrote both. She wrote over half of all of Mary's films. And while they were such good friends, not that to think of them just as a writer and a star doesn't begin to say it, because they were, they lived next door to each other for a while. Then they lived within a block of each other. They would go to the studio together at 7 in the morning. At night, Frances would read to Mary while Mary had to spend an hour a night taking care of those golden curls, washing and setting them. They would figure out which film they were going to do next together. But more than that, Frances was there at the party in New York where Mary first met Douglas Fairbanks.
When Frances Marion started writing movies in the silent era, what did it mean to be a screenwriter in the days before dialogue?
Well, I was frankly surprised when I found scripts from as early as 1915 that were 60 pages in length. So what Frances would write would be the actions, the pantomimes. Frances prided herself in having a minimum number of titles needed, those sheets that where people would read what people were saying, because she felt strongly that if there was enough pantomime, you didn't need those explanations.
The transition to sound films was a crisis for a lot of silent film stars because suddenly they had to speak. People would hear their voices. What was the transition like for Frances Marion as a screenwriter? She had to write a different type of screenplay.
Well, in some ways, they had to make dialogue instead of titles, but they were freer in certain ways because it didn't have to fit on that little single card anymore. But film still had to move. Actions still had to be portrayed on the screen. And so for a while, studios went through, for 6 months to a year, they went through a minor crisis, bringing in dialogue coaches and Broadway stars who had had practice speaking. But it was really just a crisis much more for the actors and actresses than it was for the writers. And Frances made a relatively easy transition. In fact, Irving Thalberg at MGM gave her the assignment of writing Greta Garbo's first talkie, Anna Christie. And she also had the assignment of writing Norma Shearer's first two talkies. And Norma Shearer was not only the queen of the lot, but Irving Thalberg's wife. So that underscores the importance of Frances to MGM.
Do you have a favorite of Marion's screenplays?
I love Stella Dallas. I also adore her Scarlet Letter. I think some of the talkies are a lot of fun, but the silents are just gorgeous. Maybe one of my favorites, I think, is a film called Xander the Great, which she wrote for Marion Davies. And I think the reason that I like it so much is it opens with the scene of Marion in absolutely no makeup doing a bicycle routine worthy of Max Sennett. Very funny, very clever. It's the film of all of Marion Davies' films where I think her incredible natural comedic talents come through. And it shows what Marion Davies could have been as a talent if Hearst had let her.
William Randolph Hearst.
Right. William Randolph Hearst and Frances Marion worked together for 15 years off and on. Frances prided herself in working with different studios and different producers, not being tied to just one, although she did do most of her work with MGM. And Frances Marion and William Randolph Hearst had what I affectionately call a 15-year tug of war over the proper kind of roles for Marion Davies. Hearst always wanted her in massive costume epics where she played this glamorous woman. And Frances fought very hard to have her scrubbed down playing natural comedic roles, which she thought showed her talent off the best.
Marion Davies had a long-time relationship with William Randolph Hearst, although he was officially married to somebody else, but he and Davies even lived together.
Right. He had five sons by Millicent Hearst and left them in New York from 1915 on, really, and lived with Marion Davies in California, and then, of course, built the San Simeon, the incredible castle that they lived in and ruled on for over 30 years until Hearst's death in, I guess, 1953.
My guest is Carrie Beauchamp, author of a new biography of Frances Marion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Carrie Beauchamp, is the author of a new biography of Frances Marion, one of the most successful and prolific screenwriters in early Hollywood. When Frances Marion was the highest-paid screenwriter in Hollywood, how much was she making?
Well, she set the record originally in 1916 by being paid $200 a week, which at the time set all kinds of records. But very quickly thereafter, when she was signed in 1917 as Mary Pickford's exclusive screenwriter, she was paid $50,000 a year. 2 years later, Hearst hired her to write for Marion at $100,000 a year. So, I mean, even now, these are not small salaries, and you can imagine what that bought in 1919.
Why did Frances Marion earn so much? Did she have a style that was considered to be her specialty? Was she considered to have a golden touch?
She had a golden touch in a way, although she didn't really have to doctor other people's films. I mean, she always was looking at other films, but she wrote her own. What Frances, I think, made her film so special was she had a knack for creating characters that grabbed the audience very quickly. She gave her characters clever little quirks that endeared them to the audience. Her bad guys particularly always had a fun little something that endeared them. Wallace Berry in The Secret Six is a big gangster, but he always drinks milk. And the same with Wallace Berry in The Big House. She has a scene where he cries. Over his inability to read. I mean, these were, some would say, little, you know, feminine touches to these macho male characters that Frances excelled in. She also excelled in story structure. She loved writing the beginning and the end and then filling it in the middle. She loved the arc of the story, and which is one of the reasons her frustration grew in the early 30s when the production code started to mandate more and more regulations of what you could or could not do with your characters.
What ended her career?
Well, Irving Thalberg's death in 1936 was sort of the beginning of the end for Frances, in the sense that, not that he had protected her so much as, and she called him my Rock of Gibraltar, but that he respected her. He and respected Anita Loos and the other women writers that he worked with so well and encouraged. He, in fact, when Irving died, Frances was on a leave of absence in Europe, and I found a draft of a contract in her personnel file in MGM that said that when she returned in January of 37, she was to sign an exclusive contract to write, direct, and produce for Irving Thalberg for the next 5 years. Well, Irving died in September of 36, so that was, we're unable to know what would have happened. But we do know that when she came back in January, Louis B. Mayer changed her contract to a week-to-week agreement. And Frances had been spoiled. She was the first to admit it. She had worked wonderfully for years casting her films, working with these other actors, writing specifically for their talents, and working with them in a very collaborative way. And all of a sudden, she was on a week-to-week situation where she not only was to write her own scripts, but to be available to any director, any producer, to work on whatever screenplays they wanted doctored. And she found that very stultifying.
By the time Frances Marion retired from screenwriting in 1946, I think the door had closed for women in a lot of ways. I mean, this is a period when you're, I think you're not seeing so many women writing screenplays or directing. Is there, what do you think are the factors that helped help close the door, if you agree that that's what happened?
I do agree that's what happened. I think it was a rather slow process, but I think it was not just in Hollywood. It was nationwide, and it happened to Rosie the Riveter. It happened to all the women who had come forward in World War II. And with the return of the soldiers, women returned home, and that was a very huge cultural, social phenomenon.
Yeah, but Frances Marion got started long before World War II. That's
not what helped her, or other women. No,
and,
but it helped wipe out women from the studios in so many ways that I have found in my conversations with women in Hollywood today where they have said, I thought I knew Hollywood history, and I thought women in Hollywood began in the 50s with Ida Lupino. Which is fascinating to me that, or they had a vague image of, yes, Mary Pickford also ran her own studio. But the women of Hollywood were for the most part thought to begin with Lupino in the late 50s because women were so wiped out, not just Frances and not just screenwriters, but the women in the publicity department and as assistant directors. They were, except for Dorothy Arzner, the one and only woman on the list of directors under contract in 1942.
What's it been like for you to see her movies with other people in a nice theater?
Oh, I tell you, it's for me, it's been the biggest thrill of this entire project. I mean, holding your own book in your hands is nice. Getting lovely reviews is nice. But walking in to Xander the Great a little late last week and seeing over 400 people laughing their heads off to Marion Davies was absolutely chilling to me. It was the biggest thrill I've had to know that these films are still drawing these kind of audiences. The Museum of Modern Art is very pleased with the incredible attendance they've had. It's a theater that holds 480 people. It's averaging over 400 a screening. And their plan is to show another 30 films in January and February that will mostly be the silent films written by Frances and her group of women friends.
Well, Carrie Beauchamp, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Carrie Beauchamp recorded last year. Her biography of Frances Marion is called Without Lying Down. The Museum of Modern Art's screen retrospective, Frances Marion and the Powerful Women in Early Hollywood, continues through February 17th.